Well, in the years since the terrorist attacks of 9/11, the Bush administration has received a good deal of criticism for the way it has treated suspects in the war against terror. For example, in 2002, the White House announced that it had concluded that the Geneva Convention did not cover al-Qaeda and Taliban members captured in Afghanistan, that they were not prisoners of war and didn't have to be treated as such. There have been charges made that detainees held at Guantanamo Bay have suffered treatment that is cruel and degrading, and also similar charges have been made about people, detainees held in Iraq, raising many difficult and fundamental questions about just who is a prisoner of war. How do we treat them? What is allowable in terms of techniques used to interrogate people? All difficult questions, things that I think probably a lot of people before 9/11 didn't think much about at all. This morning in this part of Focus, we'll be trying to talk a little bit about human rights and the war on terror. And our guest for the show is Jeffrey Walker. He is an attorney who specializes in, among other things, national security law and the law of war. He's a senior fellow at the Institute for International Law and Politics at Georgetown University, where he went to law school, got his law degree there, and currently is working on a PhD in international relations there. He also served as a judge advocate in the U.S. Air Force between 1988 and 2003, and during that time acted as a legal advisor on law of armed conflict policy and implementation. He also served as law of war advisor to the U.S. Air Force headquarters at the Pentagon. Has a degree in political science from Tulane, is here joining us in the studio to talk. As we do that, questions, comments are certainly welcome. I know he'll do his best to respond. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, thanks very much for being here. We certainly appreciate it.
It's a pleasure to be home in Illinois again.
It's, I guess, one of the reasons we thought it'd be interesting to get your perspective on this is because, in a sense, you've been on both sides of this fence, having been a military lawyer and someone who was in the position of having to advise the military on these matters, and now being in the private sector and someone who I think has some real concerns about how the administration has thought about these very matters. And in fact, you even were involved in filing a friend of the court brief in a Supreme Court case. This was the one involving Jose Padilla. So just as a way of starting, how do you think about this? Again, particularly as being someone who was kind of on both sides of this question.
Yeah, it is. I sense from your tone that you've had the same feeling I do. This is a huge issue. It's just an enormous area of the law. And again, I agree with you entirely from your introductory remarks, David, that it's one that most people probably didn't think much about until we started capturing people in Afghanistan after 9/11. Being on the inside, as you say, as a military judge advocate, I actually started out in the Air Force, by the way, as a bomber navigator. So I was actually an operator for 5 years before going off to law school, but then spent most of my career as a judge advocate. And it's interesting that I've done a lot of work with sort of the International Law Academy, if you will, the academic side of international law, where a lot of very great thought is put into these issues and a lot of really path-breaking writing is done on it. But on the other hand, there's a stark difference between writing kind of legal theory and jurisprudence about these issues and having to answer for day-to-day questions to captains and lieutenants and majors and sergeants who have to deal with the very tough factual issues in the field. Taking fire from a mosque, when can we fire back? Well, the book answer is it's a protected place. It's a cultural object. You're not allowed to fire back unless, of course, you're being fired at from the mosque. So now you have the rule with the exception. And the law of war is full of that. And as a military lawyer, you spend a lot of time training and answering and discussing and batting about these questions with tactical commanders, people that have to actually make the shoot no shoot decisions on the ground. And in that regard, I think military lawyers probably are sort of the blue collar lawyers of this discipline, but I think have a lot of great insight into it. It's it's a struggle in every conflict. And, of course, there's also it's not strictly a legal vacuum you're operating in. There's also a lot of policy issues involved as well. I did a lot of work in the Balkans conflicts in both Bosnia and the Kosovo air war. And the politics of those operations probably constrained our commanders' choices more than the law of war. For example, in Bosnia, I recall working with the air commander there, now retired General Mike Ryan, who was really one of the finest commanders I ever worked with. And he said as a measure of merit for our bombing campaign in the summer of 1995, when we essentially bombed the Bosnian Serbs back to the bargaining table in Dayton, for lack of a better term, he said, look, we have two measures of merit for this operation. One, get the Bosnians, or the Serbs, I'm sorry, back into negotiation. And two, zero civilian deaths. Now, that is not a legal requirement. You can't have disproportionate civilian injury, disproportionate civilian property damage, disproportionate civilian deaths. But the law of war nowhere says zero. Now, why was that a measure of merit for this operation? The Clinton administration very keenly saw that the political capital that underpinned that operation was very tenuous and a very small pile of capital, if you will. And it wouldn't take too many images on CNN at night of dead civilians or, you know, a bad bomb that went into a school somewhere to, at least in the eyes of the Clinton administration at the time, as it was conveyed to us in the field, to have the whole sort of house of cards come tumbling down around us. So that was not a law of war requirement. That was a policy decision, a policy call that restricted our choices of tactical action more than the law of war would require. So it's an interesting sort of dynamic, and it's not just, as I say, a legal vacuum. The politics, the policy choices made about a particular operation have an enormous impact.
Well, let me ask you, and it's something that I'm sure we could talk about for a long time. What seems to be a basic question, maybe the basic question when it comes to how detainees have been treated.
Right.
And that is, who qualifies as a prisoner of war and comes under the Geneva Convention? Is that really such a difficult thing to determine?
Well, as with most issues in the law of war, there's a quick answer. That would be uniformed soldiers. And then there's all the qualifiers that come thereafter, which is, yes, all members of regular members, uniform members of regular armed forces of a nation state. But also you get into sort of more interesting permutations under the convention dispositive on the issues of prisoners of war, which is Geneva Convention 3 of the four 1949 Geneva Conventions. The third, Geneva 3, is the Geneva Convention on the Treatment of Prisoners of War. And Article 4 of Geneva runs to many, many subparagraphs after that initial statement, members of regular armed forces, but see, and also is what comes after that. For example, members of militia or volunteer corps that are operating with regular armed forces, members of militia or volunteer corps that aren't necessarily operating with regular armed forces but meet four specific criteria that include wearing some open symbol or uniform, carrying their arms openly, operating in compliance with the laws of war, and being under the command of someone responsible for the actions of their subordinates, essentially a kind of organized and disciplined militia or volunteer corps. Also, persons accompanying military forces without being members thereof is the actual language. That may sound like we're talking about an archaic concept like, you know, mule skinners and scouts and that sort of thing. Well, yes, but you could not take an American military force to the field today and have them survive very long without a lot of civilian contractors going with them. And we certainly heard a lot about this with the contractors that were brutally and tragically killed in Fallujah, which triggered the first siege of Fallujah, if you will. There are thousands, tens of thousands of civilians traveling with U.S. forces in Iraq and Afghanistan. That's a lot of this discussion about Halliburton and Kellogg Brown and Root revolves around the fact that they're the ones that hire most of those people for support contracts, at least, in Iraq and in Afghanistan. So there's this whole other sort of categories of people that also, if they're taken by an opposing force, are treated as prisoners of war. The issue with the Guantanamo detainees really centers around whether or not they're members of a regular armed force or they're members of a volunteer corps militia that's an auxiliary to a regular armed force. And I think that's really where the nut of the argument rests. The decision was made by the administration that they're not.
Well, it sounds as if here, again, say we're just talking about people at Guantanamo, people who are suspected of being either Taliban or al-Qaeda.
Right.
Here, it sounds as if it would be a little bit easier to make the argument that Taliban are covered by Geneva Convention and maybe al-Qaeda are not. But again, as the way that you've described it, it sounds like you could actually also make the argument that al-Qaeda people, maybe if they were fighting with the Taliban, maybe you make the argument, well, maybe they are covered too. I mean, it sounds as if you could make a reasonable argument either way to say that they are or that they're not. I mean, is there any final arbitration on subject like that?
Well, ultimately, it's based upon the goodwill of the parties to the treaties, I suppose. You could be held accountable before an international judicial tribunal like the International Criminal Court, which the Bush administration has renounced our signature of that treaty. So there's no chance the U.S. will be called before that tribunal anytime in the near future. I think get to the first part of your comment there, David. Yes, you could, I would, and I have made the argument that the Taliban should be covered by Geneva III. The counter argument to the Taliban forces being prisoners of war generally goes something like this. Only three countries recognize the Taliban government, and the Taliban government was oppressive and evil. Okay, I agree. Those are factually correct statements. They were oppressive and they were evil. They were medievally evil in a lot of ways, and only three countries recognized them. I believe it was Yemen, Saudi Arabia, and Pakistan, the last two of those being somewhat important countries in that context that recognized them. But that is not, from my political science side of my brain, that is not dispositive, I don't think, of what constitutes a government of a country. They were certainly in effective control of the borders of most of that country. The Northern Alliance controlled a little slice in the north. They were in effective control, actually monopoly control, of the levers of power in that country. De facto, certainly, they were the government of Afghanistan. Afghanistan was a state party to the Geneva Conventions. The Taliban never renounced that membership, that status of state party. So by the terms of the Geneva Conventions themselves, they continue into effect with a successor state government until they're formally renounced. So the Taliban were the regular armed forces, if you will. I mean, they didn't look particularly regular from a Western point of view, but they were, for lack of a better term, the armed forces of the Islamic Republic or whatever it was of Afghanistan. So I think there's very thin ice in that regard. Another one of the arguments made about the Taliban is, well, they didn't really operate in compliance with the laws of war, and generally a couple of incidents would be cited of sort of barbaric treatment by some Taliban force as well. That doesn't undermine the status of the entire force. Otherwise, the U.S. military would be in trouble anytime you had a soldier, a group of soldiers who committed a war crime. The more important issue is the al-Qaeda personnel. I think is really much more, and I shouldn't say important, much more interesting and divisive issue is the al-Qaeda. And I've always held that there's al-Qaeda and there's al-Qaeda. There's at least three distinct categories of al-Qaeda. There's Osama bin Laden and his inner circle, which are, in my view, the head of an international criminal organization and nothing more. They are a private entity of some sort trying to exercise a sovereign prerogative of violence against another state. That's a crime. That's an international crime. That's a domestic crime anywhere that I know of. Second kind of al-Qaeda are these creme de la creme, and I use that term tongue-in-cheek, that were skimmed off the top of the training cadres, the people that came to these training camps mostly in Afghanistan, and were selected for their education, their ability to work in the West, their language skills, what have you, for very specialized, very expensive training, additional training. And these are the 9/11 hijackers. It shouldn't be a surprise that most of these guys came from Saudi Arabia, a wealthy country, well-educated, from educated families, traveled in the West, lived in the West, spoke English. That's where you're going to find people that can answer that job description, essentially. They are 9/11 hijackers, if any of them were around to prosecute, certainly were quite simply criminals. They were not fighting in uniform. They're hijacking airplanes, which is an international and a domestic crime. Both the World Trade Center in particular, obviously a civilian target, in the intent being to kill as many civilians as possible. So I don't see much question about that. The bigger question then is, what about the other 90% or 95% of the trainees? You know, the paradigm being sort of the minimally literate, you know, Pakistani goat herder son that went off to do his, what he perceived to be his religious duty. That's a different situation. And this is my opinion, certainly, that they fit the classic definition of a volunteer corps. The only distinction I can see, in fact, they were referred to in Afghanistan by the Afghanis as the Arab brigades. Now, they weren't all Arabs. Pakistanis aren't Arabs, for example, but the Arab brigades were used to augment the Taliban field forces, the Taliban military forces. In fact, The Economist wrote extensively about this about a year and a half or two ago. And interestingly enough, what the Arab brigades were being used for during the Northern Alliance U.S. led coalition offensive into Afghanistan after 9/11, really twofold: to protect key cities and towns, urban areas essentially, and to bolster and plug holes in the faltering Taliban lines. Now, a little bit of historical research will show you that that's exactly what the famed international brigades, maybe the most famous in our country, the Abraham Lincoln Brigade in the Spanish Civil War in the 1930s, were used to do. Mm-hmm. They had them make the stand in these in the important urban areas, and they plugged the faltering lines of the Republican forces. I point that out simply because a lot of this gets caught up with we want to call them something or deny them some status because we don't like them, because they oppose us, because they fight against us. That's a dangerous way to make decisions in the law, to be honest with you. It's in these tough factual situations that you have to make the hard legal decisions like that. But there's, you know, history is replete with these kinds of volunteer corps that have been, you know, fabled in song and story for centuries. The famous Irish Wild Geese regiments that fought for Catholic monarchs all over the world, for example, foreigners volunteering to fight in someone else's army. General Clara Chenault, Clara Chenault's famed Flying Tigers, who flew for the Chiang Kai-shek's nationalist forces against the Japanese before World War I broke out. In fact, after Pearl Harbor, they were just en masse inducted into the Army Air Corps. And they were actually being paid by the head for shooting down Japanese planes. And there's a whole mercenary issue there. So I don't want to go down that road, to tell you the truth. About Chenault's Flying Tigers. So, you know, there's because we were the ones that they were fighting against, I think it's easy to lose track of the fact that they may be part of this greater historical context.
Well, I have a couple of callers I want to get to. I want to promise those people I won't make them forever.
Sure.
Make them forever. Let me ask you one further question, and I suppose this actually is in the way. I am asking sort of for a matter of an expression of your personal opinion, which you may or may not answer. But ever since 9/11, as we've talked about what happened and what's happening in the world, the Bush administration and members of Congress and people in the news media have all used the phrase the war on terror.
Right.
And the kinds of metaphors and the way that we have talked about them have been the metaphors of war. At the same time, other people have made the argument that says, you know, that's the wrong way to think about this. That, for example, as the phrase you've used to describe al-Qaeda, this is an international criminal organization, that the attack on the World Trade Towers was not an act of war. This was a criminal act, and that would suggest a different sort of strategy. In your mind, do you think that applying the metaphors of war to what has been called the war on terror, is that the right kind of language to use? Has using that kind of language led us to do certain things that maybe were counterproductive?
Well, I mean, unfortunately, I suppose it's become something of a hackneyed phrase. We had the war on terror and the war on poverty and the war on drugs and the war on hunger and the war on ignorance and the war on everything. You know, it's interesting that we sort of find it mildly amusing, some of the idiomatic phrases translated from Arabic, mother of all battles and blood running in the streets, which are really sort of idiomatic phrases in the Arab language, I'm told by Arab linguists I know. We have those too, and I think war on, fill in the blank, has somewhat become one of those. The problem really is it's the dichotomy between how do you treat this. Is it a military war or is it a law enforcement problem? Mm-hmm. And that is the answer is yes, both. Afghanistan was clearly a war. It was an international armed conflict. The United States government and this administration agrees that was an international armed conflict. It was a war against the Taliban because the Taliban openly harbored this terrorist organization that had just proven it was willing to attack Americans and the American homeland. We said, you need to throw them out. You need to stop this. You need to arrest these people responsible. And we'd been saying that for many years, essentially, to the Taliban, and they publicly thumbed their noses at the United States. After this attack, I think the entire world agreed. We had a sound legal basis for invading and attacking Afghanistan and removing the Taliban government and disrupting and capturing as many al-Qaeda as we could. But there's other problems. Our law enforcement problems, for lack of a better word. What's Jose Padilla is a very good question. Mm-hmm. What about the African Embassy bombings? What about the first World Trade Center attack? The African Embassy bombings and the first World Trade Center attack were both handled as law enforcement problems. It is possible for the military to assist law enforcement. Now, within the United States, that's a difficult issue because of posse comitatus restrictions, which we probably don't have time to talk about. That's a whole other show in and of itself, probably. But externally, internationally, there is no prohibition in American law and U.S. law on U.S. military forces assisting the FBI or any other American law enforcement agency or taking a law enforcement role overseas. There is a prohibition domestically on that. So it's a series of campaigns. It's a series of operations, if you will. Some of them law enforcement, some of them military armed conflict, and I think it's going to be that way for the foreseeable future.
We are at a midpoint here. We have some callers we'll get to. Let me again introduce again our guest. We're talking with Jeffrey Walker. He's a senior fellow at the Institute for International Law and Politics at Georgetown University, where he got his law degree. He's now working on a PhD there in international relations. He's also a retired military officer, retired lieutenant colonel in the Air Force. He served as a judge advocate in the Air Force between 1988 and 2003, acting as legal advisor on law of armed conflict policy and implementation. He also served as law of war advisor to the Air Force headquarters at the Pentagon and is interested in national security law, the law of war, international human rights, among other things. He's a member both of the ACLU and the VFW. That's pretty good. Is here with us in the studio. We're talking about some of the issues involved in how it is that detainees, suspects in the war against terror have been treated. And questions are welcome. We're now in our second half of the show, and callers will help us by being brief. We can get in that way as many people as possible. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. First caller is line one in Champaign.
Hi. I was wondering if we could turn the discussion back to international law and the International Criminal Court. You said that the U.S. was not a signatory to that, and I remember I was in Belgium and I sat in on a class in which a Serbo-Croatian speaker was trying to encourage Belgians to become translators at the court in The Hague. And she was very excited about it and felt that she was participating in the creation of international law. And obviously she was working on the war crimes issues in the former Yugoslavia. So I was wondering if you could talk about your personal feelings or your academic views of that and what you think about this kind of phobia of that court by many Americans is kind of a political phobia. And then I guess I just mentioned in contrast to that, knowing a pacifist in Germany who felt that the whole notion of laws of war was an oxymoron. I mean, is it possible to have laws of war? So,
well, that should keep us occupied for a while.
Yeah. Thanks. Thanks for those two very, very tough questions.
Okay.
Let's see what we can do. The Hague may be the most over-lawyered city, with the possible exception of Washington, D.C. in the world. There are several international courts that sit at The Hague. The International Court of Justice, the World Court, sits there, but also the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia sits there, and the ICC will as well. The ICTY, the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia, the U.S. was instrumental in founding. In fact, Dave Sheffer, who I submitted the amicus brief in the Padilla case with, was the granddaddy. He wouldn't like me calling him a granddaddy. He's not much older than I am. The granddaddy of the ICTY when he was the Clinton administration's ambassador at large for war crimes. And I did a lot of work helping provide evidence and find witnesses in Bosnia for that tribunal as well. The U.S. has been an avid supporter of that tribunal and the one in Rwanda as well. Since their establishment in the early 90s, that's, of course, the ICTY is where Slobodan Milosevic is currently entering second or third or fifth or 12th year of his trial. That's going to go on for some time, I think. The ICC, the big phobia expressed about the ICC is political prosecutions, that the U.S. being the last superpower left standing or you know, the 400-pound gorilla on the world stage, depending on the way you want to look at it, will be open and ripe for politically motivated prosecutions. It is one of the reasons why the crime of aggression, of waging aggressive war, was not included in the original statute, although there's some attempts now to add a protocol, defining that very slippery crime of aggression and add it to the court's portfolio. The issue being the U.S. didn't want to submit U.S. military or even political leaders and U.S. military members to jurisdiction of this court where they might be it was perceived they might be subject to politically motivated prosecutions. There's a lot of safeguards built into the ICC treaty, in my opinion, and there's certainly a lot of argument on the other side, which I respect. This is another whole show, I think, David. I can find you some people smarter than me on the ICC for that as well. My personal opinion is I think we missed an opportunity. The United States has, from its inception as a nation, been a leader in the forefront of international respect for law and codification of international law, and I think we're missing an opportunity for continuing our leadership in that area. The second question, is the law of war an oxymoron? You will not be surprised, I suppose, to hear. I have heard that before. Is the law of war an oxymoron? You should also probably not be surprised for me to say no, I don't think so. There are some troubling contradictions in the law of war, however, that I've thought and agonized over for many years. One of them is it seems that the law of war spends a lot of time worrying about protecting people in uniform and not a lot of time worrying about people that are innocent civilians, whether they're enemy civilian population not engaged in the fight or persons occupying or who are citizens of occupied territory, and in fact shifts a lot of the risk of armed conflict onto these people, I think inadvertently. I don't think it's a conscious conspiracy to do so. And I'm not sure how to fix that. However, the basic underlying norm of this international law of armed conflict, or international humanitarian law, as the Red Cross likes to call it, the whole International Red Cross movement really started in the 1850s by Henri Dunant, is to try to ameliorate the worst excesses of armed conflict and to protect as best as they can the victims of war. Now, that includes a whole lot of people. That includes innocent civilians. That includes the sick and wounded on land, the sick, wounded, and shipwrecked at sea, prisoners of war. And the idea being we do what we can to ameliorate the worst abuses of those people because they are the ones that are the most helpless in a time of war. I think my personal opinion, again, is that the law of war does some good, and there is a reciprocity element built into it, which is kind of a self-interested good. It's really one of probably the most powerful enforcement mechanism in the law of war is this reciprocity issue. We treat your captured soldiers well because we hope that that will encourage you to treat our captured soldiers well. Now, that may have been as honored in the breach in the past as it has been in actuality. But on the other hand, things could have been a whole lot worse without the presumptive norm of humane treatment.
I suppose that's where people would end up the discussion. They'd say, you know, going back to this thing we were talking about, well, who is a prisoner of war and who should be covered by the Geneva Convention? I suppose some people would say, you know, it doesn't really matter what we should do is we should afford everyone that same treatment, not because we're trying to be nice to them, but because we want to make sure that our soldiers, any American who is taken prisoner, is treated in the same way.
Yeah, I mean, this is a question that we talked about right before we went on the air, David, which is the ultimate overhanging question here is the so what question.
Right.
I've been asked that many times. We had to do annual training for all uniformed military personnel in the U.S. military, and that's one of the questions I got, you know, usually from some smart young sergeant in the back of the room saying, all right, sir, so what? Why do I care? You know, the status of personnel at Guantanamo and how they're treated, for example, so what? So what if we don't treat them like prisoners of war? So what if we send them to military commissions rather than to courts-martial or U.S. district court? There's really three responses to that that I would make. One of them is the reciprocity issue, which is one, as a former military lawyer, is very near and dear to me. The second is one we've touched on already, which is the U.S. has, I think, a moral obligation to lead in this area. We were a nation founded upon the integrity of the individual, that every person is equally worthy of being given the same rights as an individual. We don't want to get into the situation where there are lesser people. An individual is an individual until such time as through due process some of those rights are taken away. And the third one, which is a little more pragmatic from a military planner's point of view, I did a lot of campaign planning and campaign plan writing when I was in the military as well. One of the things you do planning a military campaign is you analyze what was referred to as the enemy's center of gravity. What are those things we can attack to gain a victory most efficiently? But on the flip side, you also analyze what's referred to as friendly centers of gravity, those things of ours that we really got to protect, that are most vulnerable and could lead to us not succeeding if the enemy managed to get to those. Well, when you're this overweening military power, I mean, nobody can touch us as far as technology and guns and tanks and airplanes go. The issue becomes more slippery centers of gravity. But one of those is one that, for lack of a better phrase, I refer to as the American high moral ground. The American people will support a conflict unless they think we've become the bad guys. Vietnam, arguably, the downward spiral in Vietnam of public support was, for rightly or wrongly, it was perceived that American soldiers had become part of the bad guys team, not the good guys team. And the scrupulous respect for this legal regime that we helped to create and that the rest of the world expects us to comply with as well, keeps us with the white hats, keeps us as the good guys. And when we start, and I'll tell you, this last several months has just been brutal in that regard, from Abu Ghraib onward, and now last month these Marine television videotape of Marines shooting wounded and almost dead insurgents in Fallujah in a mosque of all places. It really... we haven't heard what the full story was there yet, and I'm willing to withhold judgment on those Marines until we do hear. But just the image was just horrific. Mm-hmm. And you're being beaten up by our closest allies, the Canadians, the Europeans, about treatment at Guantanamo. I mean, it's the kind of thing that preceded the collapse of support for Vietnam, and it makes me very uneasy.
Let's talk to someone else. Champaign County, line number 3. Hello.
Hi. I've been urged to be brief since we've got a full list, but people that want to talk, but I've just been going through the ACLU, and I understand you're a member of the document drop from the FBI, and there's a lot of stuff there to look through. A lot of it's really disgusting, lit cigarettes in ears in Guantanamo, and chaining people in the fetal position for 24 hours, letting them defecate where they are in place. I've heard about that. We've heard about this, but this comes from the FBI. It's curious that they would release it. They're usually very bad about FOIA suits. But one thing that bothered them was that the Guantanamo interrogators were claiming that they were with the FBI and under false pretenses, which is, I don't know what legality that has. And nothing about Guantanamo strikes me as very, very legal. As you were on the amicus brief, I'll try to stay focused here a little bit, what do you think of the response? Your colleague Ruth Wedgwood was fine with not having that. I heard her all over the place. But once it was some kind of procedure was called for, it didn't specify very much of what. And I know that some of the JAGs that they got to do these panels are not satisfied with the circumstances. It isn't like they're actually being allowed to have a habeas corpus, or they just had to do something, and it doesn't look too good to me, and I don't know how you feel about it.
Okay.
But as you're on the amicus brief, but I did have
I just want to ask a little clarifying question here. Yeah, I mean, thanks for bringing up those FBI documents. That's another one of the bombshells of the last several months that have just, it's been really body blows in a lot of ways to the image of the U.S. Are you talking about procedure you referred to? Are you talking about the detention hearings that they've instituted?
Or right.
Are you talking about the military commissions themselves?
Yeah, that's one of the things that needs to be sorted out. Well, in response to the Supreme Court, they had to do something in the way of an ersatz habeas corpus. So I guess I'm talking about these things that are. I mean, I know there's conflict on all those levels. I know there's a JAG. You were with the JAG group that filed the amicus brief, calling for some kind of action. There's a New York law board that called for. Filed amicus brief too. One of the actions that they would like to institute is to have everybody who was involved in calling the Geneva Conventions quaint, disbarring them, which would include this professor that Harvard Law School is trying to hire named Jack Goldsmith, Assistant Attorney General. I think you share my outrage. I wanted you to sort out how you feel about the response to the redress that you called for. Is it satisfactory? It doesn't seem to me.
Short answer, no, it isn't satisfactory yet. However, I wouldn't be a good international lawyer if I didn't have however. I think we're making some progress through the federal courts now. These cases are in the federal courts, and it remains to be seen what they're going to do with them. It's well overdue, mind you. Now, don't forget, in response to the Supreme Court's decision in the Razul and Al-Oda case, we answered the question about whether Guantanamo is a rights-free zone or not. We're just not sure how many rights attach there. The Supreme Court was very obtuse in that. The question was, do the federal courts have any jurisdictional reach over the territory of Guantanamo Bay? And the Supreme Court answered that, I think, fairly clearly is, yes, they do. You get habeas at Guantanamo. And that was a question that was in play for a long time. The government was relying upon an old case called Johnson v. Eisentrager, where the U.S. seemed to, or the Supreme Court seemed to imply that there would be no habeas for anyone captured under the control of U.S. forces outside the U.S. Anybody who took even a cursory look at the Guantanamo Bay Treaty, however, which is a very short instrument, I think it's only six articles long, a page and a half maybe. One of the articles, I don't recall the number right now, but it wouldn't take you long to find. It's such a short treaty. The Cuban government ceded all civil and criminal jurisdiction to the United States, and interesting for a treaty, there was no unilateral mechanism for getting out of the treaty. So the U.S. could stay in Guantanamo as long as they wanted. Most treaties, by the way, will say something like either party can get out of the treaty if they give a certain notice and a period of time to the other party, usually a year or two or however long. We don't want to do this anymore. We want to rescind the treaty. The Guantanamo Treaty has none of that. So the U.S. can stay forever as long as it wants to. And the Cuban government gave it all civil and criminal jurisdiction. Sure, that you apply the Bush 1, President Bush 1's duck test principle, that sure looks like jurisdiction to me. It looks and quacks and walks like jurisdiction. And the Supreme Court agreed on that. And they said, so you do have access to U.S. courts, but they didn't really go into any detail, as the Supremes often don't. They'll set down a basic principle and then let the lower courts chew on it for a while, which sometimes is a good thing. And that's where we're at right now, is we're having the lower courts chew on this right now to see just exactly what kind of redress these gentlemen at Guantanamo get. Oddly enough, there was a piece in the Post, the Washington Post, just a few days ago, where these men were apparently brought into a room one at a time in Guantanamo and said, hey, we did one of these detention hearings for you, which they just started 5 or 6 months ago, to review whether they are being lawfully held as an enemy combatant, which is a whole other issue. In fact, the term enemy combatant doesn't exist in the law of war. It's a creation of U.S. law, not international law. And, oh, by the way, if you object to that, here's the address of the federal courthouse in Washington you can write to. Now, imagine being the sort of Yemeni who doesn't speak English brought into this room and given this three-paragraph letter saying if you feel bad about having to stay here, you can write to the federal courthouse in D.C.
Well, they're also being told that they've had a detention hearing.
Yeah.
As opposed to having been involved in one.
Well, the detention hearing issue revolves around Geneva. I think revolves around Geneva III's requirement under Article 5 that says if you're in doubt as to somebody's status, you're supposed to have an undefined tribunal of some sort decide whether this person is a prisoner of war or not.
Competent tribunal is
competent
the language,
tribunal,
I
correct.
But that also implies that they aren't the people that are actually just the people that are holding them. There are a lot of people waiting, so keep it up. And I'm sure you're on the other side of the issue with your colleague, Ruth Wedgwood. But she's the person that usually goes to. And I tried to search for some of your material in advance, and this blue group, I wanted to ask you about that, too, because that didn't come up on the web at all. So I didn't. Keep watching, I guess.
Yeah. All right, well, thanks for the call. We are into about our last 10 minutes in this part of Focus 580. Again, very quickly, let me introduce again our guest. He's Jeffrey Walker. He's a retired military officer, retired lieutenant colonel in the Air Force. He served as judge advocate in the Air Force between 88 and 2003. He is now senior fellow at the Institute for International Law and Politics at Georgetown, where he's working on his PhD in international relations. He's also got his law degree there from Georgetown and is interested in the kinds of things we're talking about here this morning, including national security law and law of war. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. On again to another caller, Bloomington, Indiana, line 4. Hello.
Hi. You said that a little effort was usually made to avoid civilian casualties. It seems to me that both our forces and the Israeli forces have taken great care to avoid civilian casualties. The first way we avoid civilian casualties is precision-guided weapons. We literally captured Iraq without destroying much non-military property. Even the news reporters, they marveled at how little damage was done in Iraqi cities. And the Israeli IDS, they regularly kill specific terrorist commanders. They'll kill these terrorist commanders with very little collateral damage. Sometimes they'll hit a specific office. They'll put a missile through a specific office window. They'll kill the targeted terrorist commander without even hurting the people in adjoining offices.
Yeah, sir, I don't want to interrupt you because this is a fascinating area that I worked very closely in for many years, and I'd like to talk about it for hours with you. However, I completely was mistaken that little effort is taken by U.S. forces to avoid civilian casualties. Monumental efforts are taken. In my experience, I mean, I have been on my hands and knees with satellite imagery with the three-star general who was going to make the go-no-go decision with a magnifying glass picking corners of empty warehouse buildings to bomb just to minimize any potential for any damage to adjoining civilian facilities. So I personally have a lot of experience in that area, and I am 100% in agreement with you that U.S. forces, particularly with the advent after the Gulf War I of heavy reliance upon precision-guided munitions, that we've made great strides in that arena. The problem, of course, comes down to the issue of what's called the proportionality test. If you look at a target that's very important, a major command and control center or something for enemy forces, and it's right between a hospital and an orphanage, now you got a problem. You are going to kill some civilians in those adjoining buildings, but it is an incredibly important target that may tip the balance in the operation. What do you do? Well, the commander is, it is incumbent upon the commander, a responsibility put directly on him by the law of war to weigh in each hand. Okay, 50 dead civilians versus the value of this target. Which one is more important? That is a really tough decision to make. And unfortunately, a lot of times the civilians lose in those situations. And the law of war does not make civilian death incident to a military attack illegal. It makes disproportionate civilian death or injury from a military attack illegal. Now we have to decide and define what disproportionate is. Now there's a problem for you.
Well, I think probably one of the things that concerns people a lot is if you look at military conflicts, say, since the end of World War II, the ratio of civilian deaths to military deaths has – the number of military deaths has gone down, but the number of civilian deaths has actually gone up.
As a ratio,
that we're, you know, that we're having an awful lot of what in the business is called collateral damage.
Yes,
and I think that you would agree that it should be an overall a greater concern perhaps than it is.
I'm not sure I would agree with that, David, simply because I know how much effort's put into it. When you do an air campaign, and I, of course, am an old airman who spent a lot of time in air operations centers as a legal advisor, and the issue of civilian collateral damage hangs over an AOC like a cloud, constantly, daily, hourly, minute to minute. You know, you want the first thing you want to see coming off strike sortie, for example, is coming off target is, first of all, do we hit the target? Second, and you know, question one, did we hit the target? Question 1A, what about collateral damage? Instantly, that's what we want to know about. The problem, of course, is that there's policy affecting this again. In the Kosovo Air War, for example, the U.S. took a lot of flak for flying really high, for flying at, I don't even remember now what the altitude was, 20,000 feet, I think. You weren't allowed to fly below 20,000 feet, which meant, especially with the weather in that part of the world, it was difficult to actually get eyes on a target, to see if there are changed conditions to that target, if there was this, you know, convoy of school buses were driving by, or there was a civilian train on the bridge, or what have you. And the U.S. took a lot of criticism, U.S. And NATO both, not just the United States, NATO forces, that you were trading the safety of soldiers, the guys flying the airplanes, the pilots, for the safety of civilians. That is a very tough moral argument to make. Do we get more risk to these guys getting shot down by ordering them to fly lower so that they can be more accurate, they can identify targets to make sure there's no civilians in the area? Or do we shift some of that risk onto the civilians? And that's a very, very difficult problem. I thought personally that at the time that the altitude restriction was too high, although I had a lot of friends flying there. Do we find ourselves like Otto von Bismarck, that, you know, who famously said that the Balkans were not worth the bones of a single Pomeranian grenadier? You know, were they not worth the bones of a single NATO pilot either? You know, the guys in uniform signed up to take some risk. But on the other hand, being one of those guys in uniform myself, in my days when I was flying bombers, I felt very good that we tried to minimize the risk to the people in uniform. So it's a very difficult moral quandary.
Trying to get at least one more call. Sure. We'll have to be brief here. We'll go to line one in Champaign. Hello?
Yes, thanks. Mm-hmm. You've sort of talked at the edges of this anyway, but I want to ask more directly. Is there anything, if not in U.S. law, then international law, to secure a code of human rights that would extend, you know, the rights of counsel and, you know, just general human rights to anyone, regardless of whether or not they specifically fall under the Geneva Convention.
Yeah, and I can give you about a minute and a half to answer that question.
Yeah, there's within Geneva III, certainly, if you're a prisoner of war, there's a whole there are procedural rights that you're afforded. Generally speaking, if you're considered a prisoner of war and you're going to be tried with an offense, and don't forget, calling somebody a prisoner of war and giving them prisoner of war status isn't a get out of jail free card. You can still be tried for crimes, violations of the law of war, killing civilians or what have you. But you are generally required to be tried by the same kind of tribunal that your own soldiers would be tried for. In the U.S., that would be by court-martial or in federal court, either one of which could try a U.S. military member. There are certainly guarantees for anywhere, anytime. Due process guarantees are integral parts of a great number of human rights treaties. For example, the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, to which the U.S. Is a party, has a long list of due process guarantees, privilege against self-incrimination, confrontation of witnesses against you, public pronouncement of sentence, right to counsel, right to cross-examination, the things that you would recognize in an American courtroom, essentially. And additional Protocol 1, which was updating and revision of the Geneva Conventions in 1977, to which the U.S. is not a party. We signed, but we haven't ratified, but probably codifies most of the customary international law in this area, has a long litany of fundamental due process guarantees that prisoners of war get in Article 75 of additional Protocol 1, which, again, is the whole U.S. Bill of Rights list, if you will, of things, right to counsel, right to cross-examination, right to confront witnesses, et cetera, et cetera. So, yeah, good point. Thank you. Shouldn't there just be a basic floor below which no human being anywhere on the face of the earth is allowed to fall? I would say yes, and I'm not convinced that we haven't breached that floor in Guantanamo.
Yeah. so much more. We just scratched the surface. Perhaps on another day we can talk some more. But for the moment, we'll have to say thanks very much.
Thanks, David. It was a pleasure again to be back home in Illinois. So.
Jeffrey Walker, he's senior fellow with the Institute for International Law and Politics at Georgetown University and also served as judge advocate in the U.S. Air Force from 1988 to 2003.